Okay, so our session two, informality and rural transition. Fantastic to have Philip Hendrings from OECD. Philip, over to you.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you. Very happy to be here. So session two on the role of informality in rural areas, which we believe is important to bring more attention to how rural areas diversified and how the informal activities and networks in rural areas play an increasing important role. I'm joined by Alejandro Guerin from the German Development Institute, who's going to talk more about the experience and the connections of informality, smallholder farming, and environmental and green growth issues in Peru and Latin America. And Louise Fox is also with us from Berkeley University, who is going to talk more. She's going to provide more evidence, in particular, on the non-farm informal enterprises in rural areas. But before handing over to them, it's my turn. I'm Philip Hendrings from the Sahel and West Africa Club at the OECD. We work a lot on food security and agricultural transformation and working on this subject. Very soon you come to the informality aspect of the whole food economy. The presentation is the data I present is going to be on West Africa, but this is largely representative for sub-Saharan Africa, and on some slides I also provided figures for different areas of the world. So I believe, I'm not an expert on the other areas, but I believe the logics and the dynamics are very similar. Okay, this presentation, I'm going to start by talking about the spectacular population settlement dynamics over the past 60 years in West Africa, in particular urbanization, and for several reasons. One reason is it provides for nice visuals, but more importantly, urbanization and these settlement dynamics have completely transformed how rural and urban areas interact. And secondly, urbanization has also led to the creation of a food economy, which is one of the main drivers of the rural economic transformation. I will then talk about some figures that provides indications of the magnitude of these transformations in rural areas and what that means. And I think it's also be testament to the success of informal networks and actors so far, and underlines the importance of better appreciating these realities and policies, and in particular in inclusive green growth policies. And I'm going to end on giving some words like how informality in rural areas can be a vector or a leverage for inclusive green growth. Okay. Most of you might, or some might be familiar with these figures. So the total population in West Africa increased by a factor of 5, so this is spectacular, over 60 years. But the main figure in here is that the urban population increased by a factor of 22. So we had just 6 million urban population in 1950, and in 2010 we had 130 million. And just over the 10 years between 2000 and 2010, the urban population alone increased by 46 million inhabitants. It's roughly the population of California. But important also is, and what is often missing from the settlement or population dynamics debates, is that rural population increased at the same time, and not modestly, but by a factor of 3. So before you had 60 million, now you have 118 million. Rural dwellers in West Africa. The ratio is 42% urban population. But, you know, these figures are macro. They don't actually bring across what this means in actual reality. So this is the urban network in 1950. You have 115 urban agglomerations. I think the biggest city at that time was Lagos with 100,000 inhabitants. 60 years later, this is how it looked. So you have now almost 2,000 urban agglomerations. And what this map shows is like urbanization is much more than growth of Lagos, Abidjan, and Dakar. It's like across the board. It's like you have more cities and you have bigger cities. and they are distributed across the whole space. So one consequence is that the average distance between urban agglomeration reduced by 4, from 110 kilometers to 30 kilometers today. And here is what happens if you combine the urban population data with rural density data. So rural density increased, obviously, but it increased very unevenly across space. And what you see is that it increased notably around big urban settlement areas. So you have four different density layers in here, but the two highest, above 50%, 50 inhabitants per square kilometers, 95% of these areas are in an urban catchment area of a city with at least 50,000 inhabitants. So this means that rural and urban people are moving closer together. And it's the advantages of this proximity that outweigh the disadvantages of density. The 55% of rural dwellers not engaged in agriculture is an average for West Africa. But obviously it means that in areas which are really dense and very close to the big settlement areas in West Africa, this ratio is much higher. Because as I'm going to show with the next slide, there are different activities developing. Talking about the food economy, there are several changes that are happening. One is there's an increase in the quantity that is being consumed. But importantly also, there's an increase in the quantity that is being actually marketed. So rural population, 95% of their food consumption is bought on the market. So food sold on the market increased much faster than population growth itself. And over the past 60 years, the predominantly smallholder farming community of West Africa kept pace with this increase in demand. Regional imports as a share of total food consumption remained constant. These 66% marketed mean also you need infrastructure, you need actors that actually transport and coordinate the transportation from field to table. Another important transformation of linked to urbanization is a change in dietary patterns. So more food is being processed before consumption. And what does processing mean? Processing means there are activities involved in transforming agricultural raw materials and products that people are eating. And these agricultural value chains, it's packaging, transporting, stocking, warehousing, employs an increasing share of the population in West Africa, in urban but also in rural areas. We estimate, based on World Bank household consumption figures, that the West African food economy is $175 billion, which is three times the GDP of Ghana, and which is the biggest sector in West Africa. For those of you, and it is the biggest informal sector, because most of food production is smallholder. Most of the value chain is also in the informal sector. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong slide. This slide is actually showing like how these transports are organized across West Africa. It's huge quantities also in East Africa, as we have information there. What the slide shows is there are also some very big actors engaged in this informal food economy. This is the slide about the size of this economy, which shows how performant the economy was, the informal economy was so far, but it also shows the importance of everything that comes after agricultural production, because 40% of these 170 billion are not in agriculture. This is everything that comes after. So these activities, they will increase spectacularly over the coming years, because there's an exponential growth for these products and goods, and this is mainly informal. And governments interested in food security and agricultural development have to understand, if you don't look at everything that comes after the farm, your success of developing the rural economies and agricultural economies are considerably reduced. So there's a need to appreciate the importance of these informal activities that come after the farm. Some words on how to see the importance of these informal activities in an inclusive and green growth context. As I stop after reading these couple of words, employment in Senegal, for instance, the agri-food industry is the biggest employer, informal employer in the whole economy. Women, a lot of processing in West Africa is done by women. Environment and agrobiodiversity, Alejandro is going to talk more about that, and I stop here and hand over to my colleague Alejandro.
Thank you, Philip, and you have been and will be continue to be bombarded with information today, so I'm going to go straight to the punchline of this, and so that if you go out with one message, it'll be this. As Philip has said, the informality is a rural phenomenon as well. And we've seen that it's important. What I want to try to say is that there is a policy bias, actually, against informality in the rural sector because they're seen as unproductive and economically backwards. And I'm going to talk about a part of the world where, on top of everything, they are unsustainable because they are destroying our precious Amazon forest. And people are very protected of their Amazon forest, even though they've never been, but it's something like people feel strongly about, don't touch my Amazon trees. And so I'm going to talk about the case of farmers in the Peruvian Amazon who are in fact cutting down the forest to produce food and other things. So these people are like the devil because they're not only in terms of green growth or inclusive green growth, which is supposed to be both socially inclusive, economically valuable and environmentally sustainable. So these people are poor, so it's not a particularly inclusive activity. They're not producing a whole lot of value, at least that's the way they're seen. And on top of everything, they're destroying our trees, so they are not environmentally sustainable. And as you might imagine from my tone, my sarcastic tone, I'm here to like do some myth-busting of some sort. It's complicated, but I don't have time to make it complicated, so I'm just going to go straight to the oversimplification. And by the way, this is work that I've been doing, and what I'm going to talk about today is work that I've been doing with the Global Green Growth Institute. So I have like that legitimacy of like the GGGI Green Growth Agenda thing, and we're working at the government of Peru to do that. And with my colleague of ICRAF, Valentina Robilius, who is an agroforestry specialist. So the main message is the following. Going into Peru, and it's material to what I want to say, going to Peru to do an assessment of green growth for the forest sector, and I know that there's a forest session coming, but bear with me. If you try to do green growth in the forest sector in the Amazonian countries, you are immediately confronted with agriculture. It's not just about forests, agriculture. All forests are surrounded by creeping agriculture, sometimes large scale, sometimes small scale. In Peru, it's small scale. And in Peru, it's in fact that deforestation is fine-grained. It's something like 80% of deforestation occurs in plots smaller than a hectare. So we're seeing like tiny, tiny land conversion. So in trying to develop a green growth plan for the forest sector in Peru, you have to talk about smallholders. And what I want to say today, and just I'm probably like halfway through what I want to say, but the point is you need to engage with smallholders. And because the green growth narrative, like I said, it's not only that smallholders are invisible to this green growth narrative, it's just that they're sort of completely against it because, like I said, they're neither green nor growth nor inclusive. So in the time that I have left, let me tell you a little bit about some evidence that I've seen that makes us rethink this idea that they're neither green nor growth nor inclusive. Let's start with the green. No, actually, let's do that for the end. Let's start with the growth. Actually, and as Philip has said, these smallholders are producing things of value. It might be small value, but they're producing things over. They're feeding all the major cities in the Peruvian Amazon. They are producing also cash crops to feed their families. So they're involved in very, very complicated and very dynamic economic networks at the local level. So they're actually producing lots of value. It's not agro, it's not all palm oil, which is bringing in like the big dollars, but they are producing a lot of things of value for their communities and for themselves. This idea that that this activity provides no opportunity for social inclusion. It is true that they are quite poor, and the question is whether this is, and I think it's come up in the sessions before, whether these activities are just promoting or sustaining a poverty trap. And what I'd say to that is, it is true that they're poor, it is true that their incomes are low compared to other groups, and they're systematically lagging in some of the socioeconomic indicators in Peru. But I think we need to look at that. Or rather, the poverty is multidimensional. They are also not. They also don't have good access to pensions. They also don't have access to education. Don't have access to good infrastructure. So it's the whole package. It's independent of their economic activity. They're poor and they're farmers, but they're also in a place where the reach of the state is very weak. So they are not able to participate fully in all the benefits of citizenship, so to speak. So there is a problem of inclusion, but I would argue that the problem of inclusion is broader than simply whether they're producing agricultural commodities or not. And then finally, this is what is a little bit more controversial, is the environmental side of it, because they are, in fact, cutting down the Amazon forest. And this is the biggest carbon sink in the world, and people, especially in the industrialized nations, are a bit concerned that the offsets of the carbon offsets that the Amazon forest provides are going to be depleted. So they are in fact cutting the Amazon. Now I want to offer you a counterfactual with this: palm oil or soy. The difference in what these people are doing with their landscape, with big agro-industrial concerns, is that smallholders, precisely because they're poor, they don't have a lot of money and a lot of assets to chop down a lot of trees. So in their properties, they keep a lot of trees, and they keep what is called a mosaic landscape of tree and pasture and some crops, which they rotate. So it is, in fact, a much more diverse landscape than the landscape of a plantation of palm trees or of soy. So what I want to say today is that, and because they provide or they keep that mosaic landscape with multiple uses, they are in fact producing more social value than just food. They're producing ecosystem services, actually. They are maintaining the possibility for the landscape to produce water and to clean the air, et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully I've convinced you again that from the point of view of green growth, again, the three pillars of green growth, social, environmental, and what's the other? Economic. That these smallholders, in fact, are not, well, first, that they should not be absent of the conversation, because they are, in fact, a complete part of the landscape. So they have to be part of the conversation. But not only, I would go a step further, which is to say, compared to alternative land uses, they might actually be the best option for green growth in these areas. You know, that's a bit of a speculative, provocative comment, but I think that if green growth is about resolving these trade-offs between growth, environment, and social inclusion, I'm actually thinking that they are producing the best possible trade-off for that particular ecological context. And with this, I'll finish and hand it over to Luis. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Louise Fox. I'm a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and I teach in a program called the Masters of Sustainable Development. But I should say I'm a labor economist by trade, and so some of the green agenda has been new to me since coming to Berkeley. And working with my colleagues who are working a lot on climate smart agriculture, on energy, et cetera. And I've done a lot of work on how to make the transformation work for everybody. It seems that I'm in a room full of people who are informal sector shall we say, supporters and defenders and, yes?
Enthusiasts.
Enthusiasts, that's the right word. So perhaps I'll scale back some of my usual comments on this point. But I just want to say, in answer to a question that was asked earlier, there is no question that the non-farm informal sector is a route out of poverty. And I've published on it, and others have published on it. But it would be a much better route if policymakers and stakeholders listened to Marty Chen more often. So the real point is that I think when people think about rural areas, as my colleagues have been saying, they think about farmers. They may think about smallholder farmers and commercial farmers and the interaction and markets and farm, but they think about farmers. Yet the fact of the matter is, I work more in East Africa, but in East Africa, depending on the country, about half of the rural households have a rural non-farm business as well. And in East Asia, the history of the structural transformation and economic growth and economic transformation in East Asia includes an important role for rural non-farm businesses as being part of the livelihood and the livelihood transformation. I also agree with Marty that the transformation, especially with the kind of demographics that Philip just showed, the transformation to a wage economy is simply not going to happen in this generation or the next generation, and we'll think about the generation afterwards after a while. So they're here to stay. I think Marty gave a picture of what they do in rural areas. The rural non-farm business sector tends to be more intensively involved in natural resource processing. That includes agricultural production, but it also includes other things such as charcoal making. And on the one hand, they tend to be low energy, but on the other hand, some of the products may not be green. And the question is what to do. But I think the important point for me is, do countries' green growth strategies, do their reform programs, do their economic transformation strategies include this sector? And I would say almost never, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where I've done a lot of my work. And, you know, I was just looking at the outline for the Tanzanian next 5-year development plan, and it's industrialization for inclusive development. And, you know, there is no question that creating more wage jobs in Tanzania would be really important. And private sector wage jobs, you know, raising them from 8 to 10% as a share of the labor force would be great, because they're linkages to the rest of the economy. But I just looked and I thought, well, what about the rest? And I think that maybe one thing we might want to discuss in the tables today is whether the funding, international funding that's going to be available for mitigation and adaptation programs, is going to get lost in government bureaucracy and corporate agriculture and not going to be available for this sector. And I think given the one of the biggest problems is really the lack of voice of this sector. So fundamentally, one issue in low-income countries is you have an underdeveloped economy. You also have an underdeveloped political sector and underdeveloped institutions of collective action. And this sector is an example of underdeveloped institutions of collective action. The exception being a lot of the programs that WIGO and Marty Chen's group works with. So the question I think that's important is, how will the voice of this sector feed into these plans and make it work? Is there a competition? I agree with you completely that the evidence is clear that it's large commercial agriculture that's doing the deforestation, not small farmers. But if all the money goes to basically stop large commercial agriculture from deforesting, you know, in other words, pay them not to do something that's bad, what about paying other people to do something that's good? So I think that maybe is a topic that we should discuss. It's important also to understand that this sector, while it's a risk management, and a livelihood choice and tool for many of these rural households. If agriculture fails, this sector can't make it, because the demand for the goods and services produced and sold by this sector in rural areas comes from the funding of agriculture. And indeed, there's a symbiotic relationship. Households that have this kind of sector, they take the money from their harvest, they invest it in this sector, and then it's available for the seeds next time around. But so we need to think of the making agriculture work is really important to this sector, and making this sector is important to making agriculture work. Finally, two more points I think that might have been left out. We need, when we're talking about this sector, to talk about gender. There are huge gender differences. There tends to be sectoral and occupational segregation by gender. Not only do women often get left out of agricultural projects for a number of reasons, including the burden of household chores and gender norms about what women do and what men do, and lack of access to assets, lack of access to irrigation where there are irrigation schemes. The same thing happens in the non-farm sector as well, or can happen. And so inclusion means including the poor, it means including all the ethnic groups, and it means gender inclusiveness. And so I think as we're thinking about investment programs, yes, there are green growth, energy and transportation, infrastructure investments that are critical to any kind of growth and can be made and important for green growth. I think we also need to look at the investments that lower the burden of household chores on women. And I hope that somehow the green growth agenda doesn't push those investments out of the in public investment program. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Louise. Thank you very much, Alejandro. I hope interesting material for table discussions, and I'm thinking you summed up a lot of the discussions that could come now, so I'm not going to take more of your time, and thank you very much.
Thank you.